so I think we'll get started. So welcome to everyone. Thanks very much for coming along to this launch event for the Welcome to Us project, Light of Breath. Professor Fabio Brill here, who's in Nottingham here as well, and the senior investigators on the ground. So I'm going to share the first session of this, and we've got three speakers in this first session between 1 and 2:30. So first of all, Heather's going to give us an introduction. And then Petri Bernstein is into talking, and I'm from Nicoba. We'll follow that afterwards. So we're going to keep it to 20 minutes for talks and 10 minutes for questions. And I'll be ruthless with timing. So please don't be offended if I end up seeming to cut you off, just to make sure that people have enough time for questions. So first of all, we've got Javi Carell, who's going to talk to us about the phenomenology of breathlessness.
Thanks very much. Okay, so this is new stuff, and this is my first dry run, as it were. So I hope I can get everything into the 20 minutes. But what I want to try and do today is pose the question, can a phenomenological analysis reveal invisible or ineffable aspects of both breathing and breathlessness? And this is something I've been working on for the past sort of couple of years, building on my previous work on the phenomenology of illness, where I was thinking about the more general features of somatic illness and ways of describing that. And now what I'm going to be doing is applying those general characterizations to the specific case of respiratory illness and breathlessness. So by way of context, breathing is a very interesting physiological function, unique because it is both automatic and unconscious, but also has conscious override. So we can regulate our breathing to an extent, so we can consciously decide to hold our breath up to a certain point. But of course, when we sleep or aren't consciously thinking about our breath, the physiology of it is still regulated by the middle brain, James?
Brainstem.
So James, who's a respiratory clinician, is very kindly helping with the medical side of things. But if you contrast your breathing to your, say, liver function or kidneys, you can see the difference. We don't have a conscious or any trace of experience of these organs functioning, whereas we certainly do have and can very easily conjure up the sensation, our current sensation of breathing, and regulate it as well. Another reason it's interesting is because it's connected very intimately both to our well-being and, of course, to an emotional state. So if you think of something like panic, fear, excitement, surprise, happiness, these are all emotions that express themselves in part through our breathing, being in terms of speed and depth and so on. And then finally, breathing has this enormous cultural, psychological, and spiritual significance. It's connected to a range of interesting spiritual and religious practices. It is something that is in some ways synonymous with life. If you think about the baby's first breath or a person's dying breath, they're associated with marking the beginning and the end of life. Now, of course, the pathological counterpart of breathing is breathlessness, which is a symptom in a wide range of diseases, ranging from various respiratory conditions, but also cardiac conditions and some psychological conditions, such as panic attacks. So it's a very pervasive, very commonly seen symptom, if we think of it medically, and also it represents a major cause of people turning up to A&E. And it is also, one major disease whose primary symptom is breathlessness, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is going to be the third cause globally of death by 2020, so the third leading cause of death. So it's obviously a very common symptom and a very pressing medical and public health problem. Now, if we start thinking about what the sensation of breathlessness is all about, we can see that it's not a simple bodily sensation. So we've got the automatic control at baseline, but also breathlessness seems like a very composite, complex phenomenon and experience that may be based on input from the following. It might be the blood oxygen saturation level and CO2 levels, the respiratory effort and rate, the work, the information received from respiratory muscles and the blood pH levels. So when we think about breathlessness, we have to think in terms of in terms of a symptom about the multiple factors involved in the creation of it. And if we think phenomenologically, we have to think of the complex features of this experience. It's described often as a source of severe distress, but not pain. And that's interesting because it looks like on some neuroimaging work that the same brain pathways are activated in both pain and breathlessness, and also, I believe, hunger and thirst. And of course, I put a picture of an fMRI scanner, but of course you won't look into someone's brain and see what the experience feels like. So if you turn to the way in which people describe breathlessness, pathological breathlessness, they describe it as an overwhelming experience. And you can contrast that interestingly with the fact that it's quite invisible. So you might see somebody stopping on the street or sitting down or putting a hand on their chest or even panting, but that doesn't really convey the intensity and the overwhelming nature of the experience when you talk to people who are describing it in the first person. And that's led some researchers to describe it as an invisible disability. And it's invisible on multiple levels. It's invisible because of the reason I've just described, because the experience is very internal, but it's also invisible because it is, at least some respiratory illnesses that cause breathlessness, like COPD, are massively underdiagnosed. So I think there's something like 2 million people walking around in the UK with undiagnosed COPD. And there are also many cases where in which treatment options are limited, and the sense of helplessness that comes from both the clinician who has very little to offer by way of symptom alleviation and also from the patient who knows that there isn't a cure, even a treatment for their condition, this joint sense of helplessness can lead to a decline in visits to the clinic and to a certain increased invisibility of those patients as labeled as non-attenders. And then finally, invisible, because at the last stages in severe breathlessness, people become housebound, so they're literally not visible in any public or shared spaces. When people talk about what it actually feels like, and again, this is not something any brain scanning, any neuroscientific work can tell us, they talk about nausea, dizziness, incontinence as some of the kind of secondary features of breathlessness that, on top of the feeling of not getting enough oxygen in or getting enough air, can be very debilitating. And here are some first-person articulations when people describe, again, pathological breathlessness that arises from a respiratory illness. These are the kinds of things they say it feels like. And then, again, panic attacks and incontinence are very pervasive features of those experiences. So what is the phenomenology of the experience? Well, I tried to, in the next two slides, to just kind of dump a fair bit of phenomenological work. So people who will recognize the terms, that'll be great. People who don't, then I'll try to pick this up in Q&A. But if we take the fundamental assumption to be the kind of Merleau-Pontian suggestion that the modes of our embodiment determine the possibilities we have, both physical possibilities, but also we might think more broadly or more existentially about possibilities as the freedom to decide what activities and actions and things to pursue, then we can see that when we restrict that embodiment, the possibilities become restricted as well. So we might think that in the case of pathological breathlessness, the world both shrinks because the possibilities have shrunk, and it also becomes more hostile because navigating the terrain both geographically or physically and metaphorically becomes more difficult, and I'll give examples in a little while. So the kinds of choices we make become restricted in the case of breathlessness, and of course this can might lead to a vicious circle of self-limitation, which is well recognized in the clinic. In terms of deconditioning, when people become less physically active, and become deconditioned or less fit, and then become limit their movements even more because they suffer even more from the breathlessness and so on. So, and I think that this vicious circle that has been described in physiological terms or in pulmonary rehab work also can be thought of more existentially as a vicious circle that also operates on existential levels beyond the physiological. And people talk about feeling helpless, feeling despair, feeling very afraid of their breathlessness. It's very strongly correlated with anxiety and panic attacks, and also with depression. And one thing I've tried to describe in earlier work is this phenomenon of bodily doubt, where the tacit sense of bodily certainty that we have in health or under normal circumstances becomes replaced by a sense of fragility and vulnerability, and a sense of distrust of one's own body, which is very prominent in such experiences of breathlessness. And finally, the act of breathing becomes explicit. So I think the healthy, normal experience is one of walking around, picking things up, bending down, running, maybe jogging for the bus, or carrying a weight, or and so on. And in all of these activities, of course, the breathing is modulated, but it's not modulated consciously. And what happens in pathological breathlessness is that this entire act of modulation becomes very restricted, very limited, and very artificial. So it becomes also explicit, and is thus, I think, more open to thematization in the phenomenological way. So, various standing on the shoulders of at least three giants by describing the experience of breathlessness as one in which the body loses transparency. So Sartre talked about the healthy body or as transparent. Leder talked about the healthy body as absent because it's not directly thematized. And the physician Lerich talked about health as being experienced through the silence of the organs. But of course, what happens is it's not just that the body is thematized or particular aspects of the body, but also that daily activities of the sort I was just describing become a problem. So they too become explicit and all of a sudden become the focus of, say, planning, decision-making, and subject to kind of levels of doubt that wouldn't normally accompany the question, you know, should I go to the shops to buy some milk? So, moving briefly on to Heidegger, he gives us the characterization of human existence as sein können, or being able to be, or potentiality for being, on the old McCoy and Robinson translation, where what he thinks is that human existence is lived through our ability to press into certain possibilities and reject others. And of course, if you think about cases of illness or cases of breathlessness, we might be quite critical towards Heidegger and say, what we should also be doing is considering cases in which human existence is lived as an inability to be, or as a limited ability to be, or as, I guess, if we're thinking of the extreme end of the spectrum, something like locked-in syndrome, we might be considering cases of almost complete inability to be. And of course, in this formulation, he's relying on Husserl's paraphrasing of Descartes. So we've got Descartes' cogito, which Husserl, in a very kind of phenomenological, pragmatic way, reformulated as saying, our fundamental stance toward the world isn't one of I think, but one of I can do X, Y, and Z. And of course, this I can, in the case of breathlessness, will often be replaced with either I no longer can, or I once was able to, but now I'm not, or I cannot. And going back to Merleau-Ponty, we can also think of illness, and this is a really a beautiful phrase in Phenomenology of Perception, where he says, what happens in illness is that intentional arc goes limp. And the intentional arc is the way in which we're connected to the world existentially, but also, of course, physically through remote intentionality, and also some would say, spiritually, politically, and culturally. So in all of these activities, if we think about breathlessness as the kind of limiting factor, we might say that the intentional arc itself is loosened, is less taught, and therefore our ability to communicate with and influence and act in the world is also limited. Another way of thinking about breathlessness, or maybe the process of spiritualness more generally, is thinking about it as a process of self-censorship in which both motor actions become restricted once they are discovered to be increasingly difficult or sometimes impossible, but also psychologically or emotionally, people kind of retreat and accept invitations to do things less frequently. Because sometimes because they're impossible, and sometimes because they're just too cumbersome pragmatically and bureaucratically. I'll give an example in a little while. Another way of thinking a little bit more about the loss of transparency, specifically in the case of breathlessness. So you might say, as I said before, that the modulation of breathing becomes explicit. And this creates an artificial and conscious engagement with breath and with the breathlessness. And this can be both a biological engagement through having to consciously say, slow down, make sure you take a deep breath, don't overdo it, don't get into what's termed oxygen debt. So I think when you use up more of oxygen than your body can supply you with, but also mechanical. So there's a whole folklore around the various apparatuses, starting from inhalers like Ventolin and Symbicort, and going through to the oxygen, supplemental oxygen, ambulatory and home. And these are all kind of quite scary bits of equipment with lots of tubes and that again remind and embed this idea that the breathlessness is something very artificial and is lived as such. And more generally, we can think about explicitness as simply becoming second nature. When you have to consider what you can and can't do, what you can do in a certain amount of time, what you might do if, I don't know, if there is an emergency and you had to run or something. All of these things, again, become subject to very, very conscious, very explicit, and very dull planning. And of course, when bodily habits are replaced, so we said that the tacitness and transparency of health are replaced by explicitness, and that the natural flow and engagement with breath is replaced by an artificial and conscious one, we can also think of Merleau-Ponty's habitual body as requiring quite vigorous and sometimes abrupt updating. So people's bodily habits change as the breathlessness increases, in this kind of self-censoring way I was describing, but also the new bodily habits that are more slow and more tentative become embedded in the habitual body to ultimately create a very, very different habitual body from the previous one. So we see a process where there's a novelty, there's an engagement with an activity that was once possible, and now presents an obstacle or is entirely impossible, that leads to a censorship of that motion and eventually to the creation of new habits. Okay, and then if we think a little bit about the geography of breathlessness, we can really, I think, phenomenologically describe breathlessness as simply creating a new terrain where something was just around the corner or a 5-minute walk. It might now be reconceptualized or rethought of by the breathless person as very difficult, too far, I need to use the car, and so on. So the freedom and obliviousness that might have been part of the transparent and the healthy body are now replaced by hesitation and limitation. So if you think about something like going for a stroll after dinner, I think normally in health, somebody might go for a stroll, might stroll for as long as they wish to stroll for, and then turn back. without giving any of the process a particular thought, and also without experiencing the process as a series of constraints. In fact, it would be experienced as freedom. I walked as far as I liked to, and when I got bored with walking, I came back. But if you think about the same project of going for a stroll after dinner with breathlessness, then of course the question might be, am I too full? Is there going to be a toilet on the way? How much oxygen can I carry with me? What's the gradient going to be like? And then of course the freedom that characterized the healthy going for a walk is now entirely replaced by a series of limitations that give it, of course, a very restricted nature. So freedom is lost both practically in speaking, but also existentially, I suppose. And similarly, distances increase, gradients become more accentuated. And there was some work by Alessandra Tanasini from Cardiff about how when they asked people to estimate the gradient of a hill, looking at it from the bottom, and depending on the level of fitness, people's assessment of what the gradient actually was became they assessed the gradient as being more severe in line with how unfit they were, which I think ties nicely with this thought, this sort of view. And then finally, we find this kind of exclusion from shared norms. So when we use language, when we use concepts like nearby or just around the corner or a short walk or 5 minutes away, of course, with breathlessness and with the understanding and realization that these shared norms are no longer applicable to the person, there's also a kind of social distance that gets created. And finally, I talked about the bureaucratic barriers to travel. And if you think about something like booking a holiday somewhere and then just booking your flight, then of course with breathlessness, with the use of oxygen, there is the additional burden of having to get permission to get oxygen on board, paying for oxygen abroad, getting all the medical certificates required along the way, and then hoping that it all works on the day. And this is something that people with breathlessness have often noted was simply not worth the hassle anymore, and travel becomes very restricted. Now, on a very on another dimension, we might also think about the disruption of intelligibility as characterizing breathlessness. Because, of course, most generally, what illness does, as has been described by people like Berry and others, is disrupts meaning structures. So the meaning structures that were in place in health are radically destabilized around the time of symptom exacerbation or diagnosis or disease progression. And of course, at these pivotal moments, meaning is disrupted. And I think this can also give us a very important clue as to where intervention might be the most useful. So if there is, say, a counseling service, but there's a 3-month waiting list, then that's not much good for people who need the help at precisely these pivotal moments when meaning structures are disruptive. And one way in which that disruption takes place is through this repeated experience of the body as betraying and not obeying what you and not doing what you want and need it to do anymore. And what is needed is a very intense effort of rebuilding this meaning that, of course, can take a long time. Now, what happens when you think about a progressive respiratory condition is that one might regain foothold and manage to rebuild the meaning, but of course, as the disease progresses, this rebuilding has to be done over and over again, because the everyday experience of breathlessness and the everyday experience of the limitations becomes more and more severe. So how have people described the disruption? First, in terms of lost opportunities and relinquished activities, where work that is akin to kind of grieving work has often been described in the literature. There's a continuous reworking of the boundaries of the possible, this kind of constant negotiation of the everyday, a reconfiguring of the habitual body, and beginning to view the body as a problem or an obstacle or a stranger. And most generally, we can say that the embodied normalcy that has these characteristics of being tacit, of being transparent, of being absent, is disrupted. Okay, for time? Wrap up? Okay. So another thing where I think the phenomenology and the medical side become prized apart is when it comes to observing the very well documented discrepancy between objective and subjective measurements of breathlessness. So it's well documented that the objective measurements of lung function don't really correlate particularly well to people's subjective reports of their breathlessness. And this, of course, poses yet another challenge to respiratory clinicians who have a very difficult time trying to get their a good feel for what the functional level might be of a particular patient with this lung function when the correlation is so weak. So patients regularly either over or underperform compared to what their lung function, objective lung function is. And this, of course, sits well with the phenomenological distinction between the objective body, the physiological or the biological body, as Merleau-Ponty called it, and that body, the experience of that body as lived by a person. And again, some people have described it as life in slow motion. Okay. So going back to this idea of the invisibility of breathlessness. So the distress and the panic are very internal, and this poses again a problem when you think about communicating the experience of breathlessness, both to health professionals but also to others. So I wouldn't say it's ineffable, but it's certainly very, very difficult to communicate. And if you take what I said a moment ago about the way in which the norms shift and there's less sharing of social norms of the sort I mentioned, you can see that that also exacerbates the communication problems. There is also, going back to this distinction between normal and pathological breathlessness, there is also the sense that what was once a spectrum of a breathing that becomes more labored or more pronounced or becomes is speeded up as you move from rest to, say, mild activity to extreme exertion, that sense of pleasant breathlessness entirely disappeared. So what you get is a spectrum that is now replaced by a binary in which what you have is simply strained and unstrained breathing with very little in between. And also the shift from one to the other is very sudden, and the recovery process itself is extremely unpleasant. So the sense of pleasurable exertion, say when people are dancing or jogging or hiking, that is entirely absent from the experiential range in cases of pathological breathlessness. Okay, shall I wrap up? Yeah? Okay. So, I've said all this. Okay. So I'll just finish by saying one more bad thing and then a few positives. So if you think about the social architecture of breathlessness, then this unshareability I was pointing to a minute ago really undermines care and knowledge, and care, I mean, both in the sense of health professionals' contribution, but also care of the people around the breathless person. And it remains, sadly, and this is one of the reasons we thought the Life of Breath project was going to be very useful, is because breathlessness remains opaque, invisible, and also refractory in cases where there is no medical response to the problems it poses. And of course, that's exacerbated by stigma, which might lead people to masking. So on lots of blogs, people say things like, oh, when I get breathless and I have to stop, I pull out my phone and I pretend I'm just checking something, or I pretend to be making a phone call. I remember one mother, this is a woman in Australia, on a blog talking about how she walks up to the school gate and then pulls out the phone and pretends to be making a phone call so she doesn't embarrass her children. with her breathlessness. And of course, this is trailed by lots of tacit assumptions that can be lurking in the background. For example, that the breathless person is breathless because they smoked, that what they have is contagious, and those kinds of things that I think can lead to very strong emotional responses of this sort. Okay, now to finish on a more positive note, what I've described so far is how, in the experience of breathlessness, life becomes a set of constraints. But of course, people like Ian Kidd and others have also described the edifying impact of illness. And I think the main challenge here is that this edifying impact is very poorly documented. But what is not poorly documented is that there is a surprisingly small impact of breathlessness on well-being. So earlier I said it's correlated with depression and panic attacks, but also a large number of people with moderate to even severe breathlessness have a fairly decent quality of life and don't suffer from depression or anxiety attacks. Now, of course, over time, when we think about chronic conditions, that resilience might be depleted. And I came up with this notion of muffled enjoyment as trying to describe the sense in which when bodily movements are continuously censored, but you're still enjoying yourself and you want to, I don't know, run up to someone and give them a hug or join in a bit of dancing, and you can't really do that, then there is a sense of limitation and restriction, but there might also be this sort of muffled enjoyment. Okay, so what do I think might a phenomenology of breathlessness do for us? I think it can account for the richness and diversity of this experience, and I mean diversity both between patients and also within an individual's illness trajectory. It can articulate the positive yet unintended consequences of suffering. So there's lots of literature and happiness studies and people writing about challenges and adversity, describing how people grow and develop spiritually and personally through experiences of adversity, and illness is one such experience. And this positive consequences include an improvement in personal relationships, a sense of purpose and focus, an increase in people's levels of resilience, and what Jonathan Haidt calls post-traumatic growth. So what might be a role of phenomenology in the study of breathlessness? One important thing I think it can and ought to do is to articulate this idea that wellness within breathlessness is both achievable and significant. It might articulate better the difference between an outsider's perspective, and by outsider here I mean any health professional, in particular any health professional who doesn't have first-person experience of breathlessness, because there seems to be one very intense source of miscommunication in the clinic is that when health professionals talk about breathlessness, their only first-person experience is that of healthy breathlessness, whereas the patient's experience is a pathological one, which, as I explained, is vastly different. So breathlessness is a juncture of the physiological, psychological, existential, spiritual, and cultural. And I think, if nothing else, I'd like to suggest that it cannot be studied solely as a symptom because of the all the stuff I said in the beginning, and that a phenomenological framework can provide us with conceptual tools to richly and aptly capture that experience. Thank you. Okay, so So what I mean, it's I think it's one aspect, one way of understanding the loss of transparency is through this notion of bodily doubt. And the idea is that in health there's a tacit sense of bodily certainty or bodily trust, where you say you trust your that if you get up your feet will carry you, that you won't lose your vision in the next 10 seconds. And that, of course, is disrupted in cases of illness, of where the body stops, sometimes surprisingly and acutely stops doing what it's supposed to be doing. And the bodily doubt has three components. It's there are three losses. So I'm sort of using S.K. Toombs' account of illness as loss of certainty, loss of familiarity, loss of wholeness, loss of freedom to choose, and there's a fifth one which I've forgotten, in order to articulate the experience. And I'm very, also what's important is that I'm keen for it to be understood as a bodily pre-reflective experience rather than kind of yes. some kind of propositional content.
Yes. So the fact that it exists then restricts you further.
Yeah.
Because you've got a hesitancy about how what to expect from your body when you initiate something.
Yeah, of course.
So you maybe don't initiate something because of that.
Yeah. So eventually I think it's a process in which the way when you experience it for the first time it comes as a surprise.
Yeah.
But in the kind of iterative process in which it happens again and again, eventually leads to this censorship of movement and action, which I described. Mm-hmm.